You don't let anyone tell you who you are. You tell them who you are. If someone can't imagine that one person, and let alone a younger woman, could do all the things, well, then that's a lack of imagination on their part, not a lack of competency on mine.
What would you do all over again and why? I'm Natalie Carpenter, women's health and fertility advocate, Doc Connector, and former corporate brand warrior. Each week, join me in candid conversation with an inspiring public figure who boldly shares their real-life stories of adversity, impact, and what they did next, and if they would do it all over again, knowing what they know now. Welcome to the All Over Again podcast.
Hit the Palapu is a consummate multi-hyphenate, an entrepreneur, investor, author, and content creator. She's the CEO of Roshan Pharmaceuticals and the creator of Webby Honored hashtag 5 Smart Reads, a daily news curation shared on Instagram stories and on a weekly newsletter. Hit this podcast, One Smart Thing, delves deeper in a specific topic in under 10 minutes.
When asked if Hitha would do it all over again, she shared that she would relive all of her professional failures. Listen in to find out why they ended up serving her.
If you had to encapsulate what's changed between when I saw you last in, let's call it early 2020 and now, how would you even explain that?
I mean, it was an unexpected roller coaster, every single front. Family, health, work with a number of jobs. So everything, I think I'm grateful to be able to say, everything happened the way it was meant to, in terms of my kids are healthy, my family is healthy, I'm able to spend time with my parents and help take care of them, which is both a privilege and it's required a recalibration of my own schedule as well to free up that time to handle the logistics and the care. I've had some of like my biggest dreams come true. So you know me forever. So you know, like, I've been the world's biggest Taco Bell fan. So since we last met, I actually got to work with Taco Bell in a very formal capacity, emceeing and moderating a series of summits for their franchisees and executives, which was one of like the highlights of my life. I wrote a book about the vice president, Kamala Harris, which if you had asked me, hey, mama, I would have told you calling Biden Harris. I kept saying it during that primary. Nobody believed me until it happened. And now everyone's asking me what's happening this year. And I'm like, I couldn't tell you. I have no idea.
Well, you called it last time. So yes. You never know.
You never know.
The expectations, though, apparently are high, right? Everybody thinks that you know what's happening next.
Yes, I don't.
Yeah.
I knew it after the 2016 election. I'm like, there's too many changing factors. I have no clue.
So let's back up a little bit. So you have been working with Taco Bell and you wrote a book.
Yes.
So let's start with the Taco Bell part. What's your favorite item on the Taco Bell menu?
I mean, I'm so glad the Mexican pizza's back.
I love that.
I love the Mexican pizza. And I like 2 Diablos all over it. And then like a little dab of fire right before I take a bite.
So my all-time favorite is the double decker. And remember when they had the chalupa packets?
Yes.
Can you tell them, please, since you've got insider privileges, to please bring that back? Because that was it for me. There was something very special about that, like that tangy chalupa. Am I even saying it right? That sauce.
Like the yellow sauce, like the morning sauce.
Yeah, not the hot sauce.
Yeah. But I know what you're talking about.
And it was like a sweet, tangy.
It was like a special sauce that they launched when they launched breakfast.
It had a lady on the... Yes. The brand logo icon situation. Anyway, it was amazing.
They need to bring back. You know, my friend Anoob actually has like, he fully knows that sauce and like probably has a stash in his apartment. So we'll work on a campaign to bring
that
it back.
That might be very old. I mean, hopefully it's like.
Oh, the amount of like citric acid put in like a Taco Bell sauce packet, that stuff will like out. It's like Twinkies and cockroaches. It will like outlast the apocalypse.
Oh my gosh. I'm not sure they want you to be sharing that, but I love that chalupa sauce might come back, because that would be a guilty pleasure and make me go back to Taco Bell.
I don't think we should ever ascribe guilt with anything that brings us pleasure.
This is true.
I actually think we should abandon that adjective, and they're just pleasures.
I do love it. And I'm so excited that you're getting to work with Taco Bell.
Yes.
Because that is huge.
Yes.
And it was a dream. Okay. So on to the book part.
Yes.
The book part was a dream that you've had for quite some time.
Both and.
Okay.
Which I feel like sums up everything I do on the internet and in life. I had been a long, long, long time fan of Vice President Harris, then Attorney General Harris. So something about me is I fall down nerdy rabbit holes all the time. And I like get so invested in a particular topic is all I want to talk about. I am just like reading books and doing research, not for any other reason other than my own nerdy interest. And the financial crisis of 2008 was a big one of mine. Mm-hmm. And something I was always thinking about was what happened to the people who lost their, like, not the banks, which got a lot of the reporting, not the insurance companies, not the builders, but the people who thought they had finally gotten that leg up to be able to get a home, owned their first home, biggest dream. You know, we call it the American dream. All of a sudden to have that dream ripped away from them because of this greater massive crisis. What about them? And something that I was fascinated by was the negotiations between state attorneys general, the federal attorney general with the banks and the insurers. And so one news story that kept popping up was California's attorney general, Kamala Harris, who had joined the fight late because that election took a while to be called. It was a very, very close election. I think it came down to like hundreds of votes. And she immediately pulled California out from the negotiating table because she said this total package for the country won't even put in a dent to my citizens of California, to my constituency. Game over. And when she walked away, she started working with other attorneys general who weren't pleased with the bill. Beau Biden from Delaware was one. The senator from Nevada, who is then Nevada's attorney general, she was another one who supported her. And they all worked together to eventually negotiate a much bigger bill where I think California got triple than what they were projected in this. And she went further and negotiated further from the banks. And so I didn't know what Kamala Harris looked like until I was just on a business trip, had CNN on in the background, answering emails. And this woman who looks like she could have been my cousin walks across the stage. And I'm like, who that? And it's like that Chiron said, Attorney General Kamala Harris. And I was like, Kamala Harris looks like she could be my family. And then I abandoned that email. Apologies to whoever I was supposed to follow up with and went on a deep dive of her. And then what really struck to me about her is she was a woman who was probably one of the only women in a room being in a defense attorney or district attorney, being a prosecutor, then being a lawmaker. She was likely one of the youngest people in the room. She was one of the only people of color, if not woman of color in the room. And she was both Black and South Asian. And I was like, this is a woman of multitudes who clearly has a lot to teach me. So let me create my little mentoring from afar cheat sheet guide and study what she's done and figure out what works for me. So I had been doing that since 2009 and quietly on my own. So to be approached in 2020 to basically develop that into a book when the editor had no idea that this has been like how I felt about the vice president and what I was working on for so long was a dream come true. So in some ways, I had been writing this book for a very long time, not even realizing it was going to be a book. And another way, it was also the quickest writing process. I wrote it in like 2.5 months.
What is one of the biggest life lesson takeaways that you learned from studying Kamala Harris?
It is your name and your voice. Your name and your identities are your multitudes. And kind of the thesis is you don't let anyone tell you who you are. You tell them who you are. And that was actually advice given to her from her mother, Shyamala Gopalan Harris, that I've really taken with me in developing this multi-hyphenated career. If someone can't imagine that one person, and let alone a younger woman, could do all the things, well, then that's a lack of imagination on their part, not a lack of competency on mine.
That is brilliant. I mean, that is an incredible takeaway that I hope everybody is writing down. And I'm so glad that this is recorded because I'm going to listen to that over and over again. It's incredible. And speaking of, what came to mind when you shared was there are all of these people who sell
their names and their namesake as a brand. Mm-hmm. We've seen it happen in fashion. We've seen it happen in fitness and then they sell. So they have this amazing brand with their name attached, and then they sell. And all of the people, at least that I know personally, who have done that, have all been very disappointed with how their namesake and their brand was actually managed and portrayed and represented. So they all have tried to get it back. Mm-hmm. And I think that two of the three have successfully, that I know personally, have gotten them back. But when you say that, it seems like it stretches all the way across from the personal to the professional. That just really struck me. That struck me on multiple levels, as something like, know who you are, be who you are, but mm-hmm. also don't let someone not only tell you who you are, but don't let somebody literally take that away from you.
I agree. And I think it's very important that you, if you're going to build a business based on your brand or your personhood, try to think about what is something that you could sell and name it accordingly, which is what I've done with my Five Smart Reads news curation, is because that could be its own spin out newsletter that I sell down the line to a media company or to someone who wants to grow their audience. But I'm not selling the Hitha Palapu brand. Like, that I keep to myself, that I own. I'm not letting anyone touch it.
Right. Especially Hitha on the go. You would never, ever let your name go.
Yep.
Brilliant. So we talked about rabbit holes. Mm-hmm. What is a rabbit hole that you've gone down recently?
It's a niche, like gossipy one, but I just saw a Bollywood film called Rocky Aur Rani Prem Ki Kahani. It's very cute. It's very fun. It has like vibes of the Bollywood rom-coms that I grew up watching. And the lead actress in that and the lead actor, they have great chemistry, but their real life partners were at one point engaged. So I kind of just went deep down that gossipy rabbit hole. It was a great summer rabbit hole to be down.
What's the current situation with this couple?
So you have Alia Bhatt, who is the lead actress. She's married to Ranbir Kapoor, whose ex-fiance is Deepika Padukone, who is married to, who's now married to Ranbir Singh. Ranbir Singh and Alia are in the movie. Ranbir Kapoor has cheated on many a girlfriend, fiance in Bollywood. And Deepika Padukone is now with like her current husband, just worships the ground she walks on. Like, he is the biggest hype man for her. He is this incredibly handsome man. But when she's next to him, he just can't keep his eyes off her.
So there's still a thing happening. So, you could just feel it.
No, I mean, interesting to see how you both have the, like, both couples ended up in the couples they needed to be in.
But there's still chemistry in the original.
Of course. Yeah. And I think like they still act in films together and whatnot. And it just is interesting to one, think about one, gossip is fun. And I love like the salacious, juicy stuff as much as the next one. But people do grow up. And for all intents and purposes, it looks like Ranbir has gotten over his playboy ways and has settled down into a really great marriage and stable marriage with a woman who's like the Jennifer Lawrence of India. Like, she is one of the most talented actresses where she fully becomes the character to the point that you forget who Alia is and who the character she was playing is. She's immensely talented, in my opinion, more talented than he is. And he like has handled it decently well to like be a proud husband of someone whose star is very much on the rise and is crossing over into Western film and killing it.
You are very intentional about calling yourself a multi-hyphenate. Mm-hmm. Tell me more about that.
I refuse to be put into a box that only encaptures part of my personality for other people's comfort. I'm really done making other people comfortable in how they view me. And if you can't handle me at my most, then you don't deserve me in one archetype or one sliver of who I am. I've seen women especially be pushed into boxes that never capture them, whereas men are given these huge, like Walter Isaacson style biographies that show their multitudes and show their nuance. Meanwhile, we're reduced into really sometimes negative stereotypes.
Right. Stay-at-home mom mm-hmm. is one that comes up a lot, or a specific job function at a corporation. Mm-hmm. Usually those are the two, right? Like, you get those, and then You're right. Then there are some other negative, but I'd be curious to know. So when did you realize that I want to be known as this multi-hyphenate rather than just the CEO, which is amazing, this incredible title as CEO of Roshan Pharmaceuticals?
I actually can't even remember the first time I called myself a multi-hyphenate. So it had to have been over 10 years ago. And even like before I had kids, because for as long as I've been creating content online and speaking, I've also worked in pharma. Maybe the other world has kind of viewed an either or. For me, it's always been both and. And I think at some point I just got tired of shrinking myself to the room I was in and the audience I was with. And I'm like, no, you're going to get to know me for all of, in all of me, not just a sliver of me. And from there, I just would say it, and it invited curiosity. It never invited judgment, which I think gave me the confidence to keep calling myself this.
And speaking of curiosity, you've really grown up in a male-dominated industry, pharma.
Mm-hmm.
So how has that impacted your company, being that you are a female CEO in the pharma space? And what do you think that pharma as an industry can do better?
Well, I have to talk about the fact that I have my job because my father is the founder of the company, and I've had the privilege of building companies with my father during my time in pharma. So there is the nepotism factor, and I'll be the first to highlight it and to call attention to it, because I can never, I would have never had this career or have gotten this far had it not been for that leg up. And so it is a privilege. It has also been hard to build a company with family. It's got some incredible, incredible benefits, and it's got some challenges. So I want to address that first. Second is pharma can do a whole lot more, and I've seen incremental progress. So that's not to say we haven't improved, but women weren't enrolled in clinical trials at scale until the early 2000s, because clinical trial sponsors were just like, well, how do we address for menstruation? How could it affect the outcome of the study? So we're just not going to enroll menstrual women into a clinical study. Now we've come to say, well, we actually need that data of what happens when someone's on their cycle, when someone's not on their cycle, to see if there could be any safety concerns. Like, that's a reason to actually over-index. Same with in enrolling different ethnic groups and racial groups in clinical studies. How one certain group metabolizes a drug could be very different than another. And we need to understand that. Something that I think a lot about is how South Asians are more likely to develop, four times more likely to develop heart disease than a Caucasian population.
Wow.
And with developing injectable aspirin, clearly that's like a big part of, it's not just that we're developing a faster, more consistent version of aspirin, but it's thinking about how do we make sure we're working with people who are on the front lines of caring for underrepresented communities to make sure they know about our product and to work with them.
Absolutely. And with injectable aspirin too, I would imagine that you can control the dosage so that you can also be cautious based on who is taking the aspirin.
Right now, we're just focused on the cardiovascular use. So Okay. Basically just going head to head with oral aspirin as it's used in hyperacute cardio settings.
So tell me more about that. And is that because of the need in the South Asian community that you've seen that this direct correlation to heart disease?
It's actually larger. Heart disease remains the largest killer in the United States, more than cancer, more than stroke, more than diabetes. It is still what is largely killing American and globally people, men and women. With the case of heart attacks, women's heart attack symptoms are very different than men's.
Tell me more about that.
They are more subtle. They might have shortness of breath. You may not have the chest pain or the shooting pain in your arm. Women can be nauseated as a form of, as a symptom. They can have symptoms that might think may get them triaged for a panic attack or food poisoning, not necessarily a heart attack. And we've made great advancements in managing cardiovascular health at an early diagnosis for people who might be risk of a heart attack, and surgical treatments in care of heart attacks. What we haven't really innovated in is the diagnosis. And that is There are three things that happen when someone is suspected of a heart attack and they're in the emergency department. They're given aspirin, they're hooked up to an EKG, and they're given a blood test to evaluate their troponin levels, which usually indicate heart attack if there's a blockage that's impeding flow to the heart. In those cases with troponin, women have more sensitive, we are more sensitive, our troponin levels are tend to be lower. So what might look healthy for a man could indicate a woman could be very much having a heart attack. So we've made improvements with a high sensitivity troponin test. EKGs are EKGs, but even then, our symptoms and our EKG could look very normal when someone is still having a heart attack. And the last is aspirin. Oral aspirin is a great drug. It is so effective and so useful. But for someone who, where every minute counts, waiting a minimum of 20 minutes for it to enter your bloodstream, and then it being widely variable from patient to patient, is not going to, it could be life or death. So having a faster onset, consistent presentation of that same aspirin can hopefully, we hope, will help save lives.
That's brilliant. And how far along are you with getting the drug approved?
We are in development. I would say, can't really say because it depends on if there's a government shutdown, then the FDA shuts down and everything can slow down. So I can't really speculate to a date. We hope to file next year.
Oh my gosh, fingers crossed. That would be yes. Incredible. And every minute does count. That's so important. And I'm rooting for the company and for this drug to pass. Speaking of wellness and being the CEO of this pharma company, you have this group of women, I'm sure, that work for you. How are you doing things differently at your company to support women in the pharma industry?
Within our company, I would say it's 1/3 women, 2/3 men. Again, that's just the nature of the industry.
Sure.
We hired who our team had worked with in the past. And so some of them happen to be women, some happen to be men. What I am very proud of is the fact that we run a fully remote company. We work asynchronously. We do not spend all day in meetings. We meet when we absolutely have to. We're big on picking up a phone and having a discussion if there is a question or a query. But for the most part, everyone works as they work best. And we allow our team members to have full lives that encourage it. Many of my team members are grandparents. So I love that they have the flexibility to spend time with their grandchildren, but are still contributing significantly toward the company. Similarly, when I was out earlier this summer, recovering from my hysterectomy, my head of ops not only just handled everything, but she had also had a hysterectomy at a young age. And her telling me exactly what to expect and not sugarcoating it was the best mental preparation I could have asked for as I went in and was shocked, but also expected to be shocked.
So what I'm hearing then is that it develops sort of this opportunity for increased productivity in the company, number one, but also this sort of sense of community where you're really nurturing and taking care of each other.
Yeah.
And so speaking of this colleague of yours, your VP of ops that shared her experience with having a hysterectomy, I mean, what did you learn from her and what would you want to tell women to expect? Because it can happen at an early age and it can happen quickly and you have to make a decision quickly. Mm-hmm. So I'd love to hear your thoughts and what your takeaway was and what you'd want to share without sugarcoating.
Sure. And listen, there are a lot of reasons why someone could need a hysterectomy and why they end up there. For me, it was because I had cervical dysplasia that my OB and then the surgeon did not want to develop into uterine cancer or cervical cancer. And because I knew I was done having children, that was the most complete and highest probability of success option. And so I elected that for that. Other people might get a hysterectomy for endometriosis treatment as like nothing else has worked. Some might have diagnosed cervical cancer or uterine cancer and need a hysterectomy for that reason. So there are many reasons why someone could need a hysterectomy. For me, it was cervical dysplasia. The second was I'm very lucky and I recognize this to one, have the best OBGYN in the world. I'm like obsessed with her. And I was like, just because I have a uterus, does that mean I don't come in anymore? She goes, no, 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 you still come in for your annual well check. And I'm like, okay, good, because I would miss you. But she also made sure she's taking care of me beyond her direct care of me. So she made sure not only when she like gave me the, hey, after this many irregular paps and copals, I think we need to go move forward with a more invasive, we're no longer at the weighted monitor and wait, we're at, we need to intervene. I gave your name and your number to the best gynecological oncologist in the city. Someone from his office will be reaching out. You're in perfect hands with him. And that was in March. And I had my surgery in June.
Wow, so things moved very quickly, but you really have to when you're seeing irregular sort of
exactly
pap smears mm-hmm. and abnormal cellular activity, right? So it makes sense that you move quickly, but that's so scary that it does move that quickly. And also you don't anticipate hysterectomies in younger women.
Nope.
And I have a friend too who recently had a hysterectomy, and I remember thinking, wow, you know, you barely have time to process it before you're in the OR.
Mm-hmm.
And there you are. But but what is interesting is that it's supporting reproductive health at the next phase in overall health, right? Because they're literally working to make sure that we're staying alive.
100%. And so specific things that my colleague told me about the hysterectomy is just the pain is going to be largely from the gas you're pumped with laparoscopic surgery and not so much about the removal of organs or the incisions themselves. She told me I would feel like I got hit by a truck and that I will be sobbing. We have very similar pain tolerances. So she goes, don't take the Percocet unless you absolutely need it, but no, it's not going to help with the gas pain. So my husband's like, I'm going to go pick up the Percocet. I'm like, it's not going to do anything. This is physics. This is pressure in my belly. It has nothing to do with that. But she would like text me. She goes, get up and go walk around. And she sent me this little uterus pillow that I still like sleep with every single night. Like it's a very comfortable thing to snuggle. But she sent it to me both for a little bit of comfort. And also she said, bring this with you at the hospital because on your way home, put it just over your abdomen so the seatbelt doesn't irritate your incisions.
Brilliant.
Brilliant.
Yes.
And so everything that she had taught me and everything I captured from those the days before and the days right after, I put into like a very comprehensive post on my website to basically be like, y'all, I wish this like resource existed when I had mine. So here it is. And anyone can DM me anytime. And I'm there for whoever is going through this. Because to you said, there are a million reasons why someone might need a hysterectomy at whichever age. And we need to bring out the multitudes of this extremely common surgery and talk about it more. And it can't just be among women or people with uteruses. It has to also involve the whole family because being out of commission for those weeks and recovering will impact a family.
Oh my gosh, 1,000%.
So they need to know how to care for us in such a difficult situation. And I also then say, Dr. Khan, also when I was in a really low mental health spot 6 weeks post-surgery after my two pregnancies and deliveries with my sons, like clockwork, depressive, anxious feelings started flooding me and I didn't recognize myself. She immediately put me in touch with a perinatal psychiatrist who actually gave me a diagnosis that wasn't like treating the symptoms, but fundamentally changing my life with like the right diagnosis and the right medication.
So let's talk a little bit about that because mm-hmm. we don't talk enough, not just as women, but in general in society, about how hormones fluctuate and how that affects mental wellness from pregnancy, from postpartum, after a hysterectomy. Did the doctors prep you that your hormones were going to fluctuate after having the hysterectomy? Were you ready for some of the experiences that you'd already had during, you know, pregnancy and postpartum? Did you know that was going to be a thing? Or was it a surprise? And what was sort of the diagnosis and next steps?
Yes. So I had had severe postpartum depression after my first, delivering my first son, my older son. I had prenatal depression with my second son. So I knew that I had a high likelihood of depression or anxiety after this surgery. And it was something I discussed with my therapist. We kind of put together a screen that we then shared with my mom, my dad, and my husband to say, if you see me exhibiting some of these symptoms that I know I exhibited when I was in a depressive phase after the kids, or just in general, I've had struggled with depression for most of my conscious life. So this isn't anything new, but we were trying to be as proactive about it to let me know. And I know to like immediately then follow up with my OB to get talk about psychiatric help, because we knew likely it would not just be able to be managed with talk therapy. And so it was my dad who was like, we're there, you're there. And I did. I talked to Dr. Khan, who then referred me to an amazing psychiatrist. And in that very first appointment, when I gave her the whole history, I don't think I've actually already told any talked about this publicly, but I'm happy to hear. She said, your depression and your anxiety are symptoms. This isn't the root cause. I wouldn't call you having clinical depression or clinical anxiety as your definitive diagnosis. She goes, from what you tell me, it sounds like you have bipolar too. And you hear bipolar and you have a certain stigma in your head. And I certainly did. And I was like, can you explain why you think it's this? She said, sure. She goes, with bipolar two, the manic and depressive episodes can often be so subtle that you just think you have hyperproductivity and you're feeling a little sad.
Fascinating. So you're super productive and sad at the same time. So you're overcompensating.
It's like I lived on a constant roller coaster. I'd be up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down. But it would be such subtle up downs that I didn't recognize it wasn't healthy. I just thought that's how I am.
What you're sharing right now feels like life, right? Like most of us.
For me, it was I would have some self-sabotaging behavior, like where I would drink too much, like to like cope with my stress. And it was pronounced and it was in a pattern enough. And I had had increasing pretty bad depressive episodes over the past couple of years where I said, this is no longer livable like this. Like I need help. And really, I thought she would say, you have depression and you need an SSRI. And she goes, has an SSRI worked on you?
An SSRI, please explain.
It's just it's a certain class of mental health drugs. It's like selective serotonin receptor inhibitors.
I see.
So it addresses for one specific neurochemical imbalance in your brain. For me, the depression was a symptom. It wasn't the root cause of why I was feeling this way.
But oftentimes, depression and anxiety are symptoms of a root cause that we're not able to.
Sure.
And identify I'm not that. Saying, no, that's why I'm so curious as to, and that's why it's so fascinating, because I think this is another topic in mental wellness, right? That people are so afraid to talk about. Yeah. Why is it that every conversation around women's health always has a stem of being taboo? I mean, think about it. Like everything we're talking about, people are afraid to talk about because I mean, no wonder why people branded us as witches and burned us at the stake back in the day, right?
100%. Listen, well, I'm gonna cop to it. When I heard bipolar, I didn't hear the bipolar two and the subsequent direction. I just was like, oh my God, I'm insane. And again, this language we have normalized to just describe and to stigmatize what is just basically a neurochemical imbalance in your brain. We really need to be more mindful of how we talk about it to create better, greater empathy of what is shockingly normal. So rather than give me a drug that's usually prescribed for clinical depression or anxiety, she prescribed a mood stabilizer for me that has changed my life. It's been 8 weeks and already I'm just like, is this how I was supposed to feel? Like there's still ups, there's still downs. That's life and that hasn't gone away. But I'm able to manage the downs and the ups, still celebrate and enjoy the ups, but they're not like manic and euphoric and like at the top of a roller coaster where you're going to go crashing down.
There's a saying, as you know, the highs are high and the lows are low.
Mm-hmm.
And we're sort of educated to believe that that's very normal. I mean, so that's why when I'm hearing you say that, if we don't know what is and isn't homeostasis or meant to be homeostasis for our bodies, then how do we know if it's up or down? Because I think we all have lives that feel like roller coasters mm-hmm. at times, sometimes more than others, depending on what's happening in our lives.
Yeah.
But as you're speaking, I'm thinking, well, could I feel better more consistently all of the time? Right. And That's why I just feel like education is so key. And right, the vernacular does need to change. Yeah. I mean, from the word bipolar to words like
crazy,
or even like, I'm going to go far off on the reproductive, female reproductive side here. But when people talk about spontaneous abortion or miscarriage, like geriatric pregnancies, I mean, these words are so hurtful.
Yes.
And so awful. I mean,
and clearly created, like these terms were created by men.
1,000%. That's why I love that you're a CEO. Nepotism or not, I love that you are killing it being a CEO, a female CEO of a pharma company, and changing the perspective on what the industry needs to look like and how a company, number one, should be run, but also how we can support an entire company, men and women, inclusive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's part of it, is being inclusive. I feel like growing up in a male-dominated industry, I got my start in auto, and then I finished a few years ago my corporate career in auto, and it was largely male-dominated. Not largely, it is male-dominated. Mm-hmm. And I had an amazing experience on the back end with that company. And on the front end, it was a major learning of my life. Yeah. I don't look at it with regret, but wow, yes, things have changed, but not really, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you still don't go as a woman out past witching hour with, you know, the colleague set that gets hammered. I mean, you're just inviting bad news bears.
And you're also penalized if you're not able to go and hang for a period. It's like damned if you do, damned if you don't.
True. I always knew there was a specific time of the night, especially when I was single, mm-hmm. that I needed to be out, that I needed to go home, that nobody would notice.
Yep. Your Cinderella hour.
Yes. Because that's when everything would change. People would get very loose-lipped and they would share way too much. And fine, that was interesting. I purposefully didn't drink that much in those settings. Mm-hmm. But then later on in my second career, when I was married, I would just slip out early because I just thought, okay, I am more comfortable, you know, myself and with these people, but I'm still just not going to be out late because then I might drink too much. And then, you know, who knows what's going to come out of my mouth. And the authentic me is pretty filterless, so therefore I didn't stick around. But it's interesting. I feel like being in a male-dominated industry can be very, very trying. So.
And I think that's why I've always had the second career as a content creator, because I needed to fill another cup with what I had been missing in that industry. And I knew I could still work on making life sciences a more inclusive place and a safer place for women and underrepresented folks. And know that by blogging and writing online, I could also be connected with an incredible group of like-minded women who had their corporate jobs and were also building these digital empires on their own.
I feel like you've been very supportive of women, particularly female entrepreneurs and moms. Mm-hmm. Are you still very connected in sort of that realm? And are you doing any special projects to that end? I'd love to hear what you're up to.
Yeah. Right now, I am not as involved with the communities, just because I feel like if I have time or bandwidth, I'm either with really close friends or I'm at home with my own family.
Sure,
and
sure.
Taking and resting and prioritizing better nutrition, better sleep, time to work out, all the things I should have been doing all along. So I think formally, not so much, but my 5 Smart Reads contributor team, they're all women.
Amazing.
Many of them are moms. And to be able to offer a paid writing opportunity that is incredibly flexible and focused on helping everyone start every day smarter, I'm excited about that. And I'm happy about that. And my team, my editorial lead, my manager are both moms. So to also run this business the same way I run Roshan Pharma, asynchronous. We check in when we need to. Everyone is clear on what they need. We hop on a call when we need to and touch base when we need to. But the rest of the time, we're all getting our work done and we're also living our lives.
I love that. So would you say that you're very mindful of when you're hiring what each individual might be living through as a mom, what have you? Would you say that that impacts your hiring at all? Like the average male-dominated industry/company would look at a mom and say, how much time could she contribute towards my company? And is she going to be around, especially if she's in the process of having more children in the near-term future? Based on the way you've sort of set up your company to be very flexible and such, when you're hiring, are you mindful of, wow, I know what it's like to be a mom, and I know that if I give a mom a job, she's going to kill it because she's going to get things done on her time and she's going to do it well because she cares. I mean, like that's my perception, yeah. But I'm curious.
You know, now that you mention it, I think back on the hiring decisions or the vendor selection decisions I've made over the course of the content career. And yeah, Austin, my manager, happened to be a mom, and Tabor became a mom while she was working for me. I was very proud to offer her full paid leave. The woman who backfilled for her, also a mom. And then when she was ready to move on to a different type of role, gave her everything I could do and put her in touch with a career coach to support her on that journey. My comms team, run by a woman I met when I was pregnant, she was a mom of three. And I was like, oh my God, I hope like my brand is at a position to be repped by you one day. And like Rekia is amazing. And to this day, I still ask her mom questions and like PR and comms questions. So she's just a great, great friend. And the graphic designer I'm working with and developer for like a full digital rebrand is someone I met in the Hey Mama community when I was looking to give my pitch deck for Roshan Pharma a glow up. Worked with her. She's been amazing. And now I'm like, oh my God, I trust you. Please help me with this.
So speaking of glow ups,
yes.
If you could give any piece of advice to the pharma or any male dominated companies out there about hiring a mom, a woman, but mm-hmm. specifically a mom, what would you say?
I would say mothers are like the best resource to hire for. Motherhood prepared me for entrepreneurship and like fundraising better than anything else, because I'm very comfortable with rejection and negotiating with irrational beings and having to get to a very specific outcome. Like I have been told no more times in that 7 to 8 o'clock hour of getting my kids up and ready and fed and off to school. And then I will be told throughout the work block when they're at school.
I'm like crying because this is so true. I'm like laughing, crying because the rejection is so real. And that is so much more personal than anything could ever be in the workplace. I'm literally crying, laughing.
Like I can really shrug off a no to a potential investor or partner so easily. Like my children have prepared me for this.
And then maybe that no becomes a maybe because you're like, well, I'll just try again later, maybe
exactly.
After you're fed. Because
exactly. It's like, whoa, buddy, big feelings. And then also in the nature of drug development, way more things go wrong than go right, which also explains motherhood and parenting in a nutshell. So with my team, I constantly remind myself, if this were easy, everybody would do it. It is not easy. You need to have a certain level of grit and resilience and being comfortable with failure. And motherhood really prepares you for that better than anything else.
1,000%. If you had the opportunity to do anything all over again, what would it be and why?
I mean, this is such like a cliche answer. I feel like everything has really informed. Everything experience I went through has helped me become the person I am today. I would not have bought some of the things I bought in like my early youth. Like, why did I need that many going out tops? Why did I need five pairs of those Steve Madden platforms? Why did I spend so much money on drinks and like going out? I wish I had just stayed in a little more, saved my money a little more in my early 20s. Oh, and I wish I had never over-tweezed my eyebrows. Because now I spend so much money on microblading.
I'm just trying to get back there. I am in that process of just trying to get them back.
I have a great microblading person. She's like right around the corner from here.
Okay. I need to learn more about microblading in general.
It's just like semi-permanent tattooing.
Okay.
But she's amazing.
Really?
She's amazing. And like I had gotten touched up and it had been over a year. So like, she's fantastic.
I love it. Okay.
So yeah, I wouldn't have plucked my eyebrows. I would have saved my money. I wouldn't have gone out so much. That's about it.
And is there anything in terms of your business that you would ever have changed?
I mean, I have things that I wish had different outcomes. There's a lot of development programs I worked on that I wish had worked out, and we hadn't had unfavorable clinical study results or major manufacturing challenges, or the partnership would have worked out. But I've learned so much from all those failures that I think have prepared me to run and lead this company and this development program the way I have. So yeah, I would say specifically in Roshan Pharma, I wish I would have brought on Beth sooner, our head of ops. I wish I would have hired our particular law firm, outside counsel, sooner, because they're fantastic. Like, they're truly amazing, and I really enjoy them, and I'm grateful for them. And I feel like lawyers often get a bad rap, but I'm like, oh my God, for every founder out there, your law firm, your outside counsel can make or break your business. So hire carefully. And if you feel like it's not the right fit, move on immediately. Do not try to make it work.
I think that goes for absolutely everything in life.
Yeah.
If it doesn't feel right, yes, from your doctor all the way, yes, to a relationship, those red flags are coming up for a reason. Mm-hmm. So see them, listen to them, and take heed and run.
Yep.
So I like that piece of advice. One question I've been wanting to ask you.
Yes.
So what was the inspiration behind Five Smart Reads? Mm-hmm. And what are you reading right now that we should be reading?
Okay. The inspiration behind Five Smart Reads was really something I'd been doing since high school, which is starting the day reading the news. I'd competed. I was that girl who was on the debate team.
Of course you were.
And I competed in extemporaneous speaking, where you had an hour to pick a random topic, either national or world news, out of a bag, write, research, and memorize a 10-minute speech about it, and then deliver said speech. So just having a pulse on what was happening in the world was like just a necessity. So that way, when you did the research phase, you weren't completely informing yourself on the subject. So that habit just kind of continued on throughout life. And I remember, 2 years into the Trump administration, people just had news overload.
Don't we still?
I think we do. I think maybe we...
But I agree. I agree that I feel like that's when it hit a tipping point for me. But I feel like that has continued.
I don't think media has not changed.
Yes.
But people have changed where we are opting out. We no longer watch, or we watch very selectively. Yes. We are thinking about a more varied news diet. And we also know when it's just too much to step away because we're not getting anything from it. So Five Smart Reads was really able to say, hey, this is a little bit more, the skim kind of highlights what's already trending. Niche news often went so deep into granular, like rabbit holey detail that I knew that wasn't accessible for most people. So I said, okay, what caught my eye? And it usually was explaining like kind of a healthcare story because I had the subject matter expertise to help explain that. It was a couple like global news stories or news stories focused on women, focused on moms, focused on groups of color that I was like, this isn't getting the attention it deserves. And then kind of some fun, inspiring stories as well, because we want it to feel happy and uplifting, not just doom and gloom all the time. And I did it to kind of maintain my relationship with the community I had built off the blog, because I said, I don't have the bandwidth to write Hitha on the go and produce that content at that frequency and quality anymore.
Blogging is so wonderfully time consuming to, yes, the point that, like you, I'm either in it or off. And I think I've been off for years now because I just don't have the energy anymore.
Yeah. I mean, I was expecting Rocky. I was full on into raising for this company. And before that, going through a really big legal cleanup overhaul. And I just didn't have bandwidth. So I was like, what can I do to continue communicating with and nurturing my audience? And so Five Smart Reads was crickets for the beginning. Like, it got no engagement. And after a few months, people are like, oh, I guess we'll start swiping up. And this was at the time where it was still swipe up on the links. Then friends of mine who had large audiences were just like, this is really cool what you're doing. I'd love to amplify it. And that helped drive engagement and growth of my account. Same with the newsletter. So I'm very anyone who's building anything on social, you need to immediately make sure you have a way of communicating with your community off of that platform. Newsletters are great. Blogs are great. I'm a big newsletter fan. I consider myself more of a writer than like a full content creator already, because that's just the medium I feel most comfortable expressing myself in.
I love to write too. I love to write so much. That is why sometimes social can be daunting for me, because I will want to tell everything and share everything, and I want it to be perfectly written. But that's another story. So you've got 5 smart reads.
Yes.
And your podcast episodes are 10 minutes or less.
Well, that podcast was a short-lived experiment.
Why? Let's get back to it. This is what people can consume. You know,
I want to. I kept committing to a date, and that date just went flowing by. So I am very committed to saying One Smart Pod or whatever it'll be renamed will come back in that format I want to return to. But I also think it has to be when I know I can commit to it. And right now I cannot.
When the time is right.
Exactly.
But I love the format that you're doing. 5 smart reads and eventually a podcast that's 10 minutes or less. Last question. What is one of your 5 smart reads that we should be reading right now?
Okay. There's a lot of conversation about drug pricing, drug transparency, transparency in pricing, negotiations, et cetera. So there have been a lot I've shared on 5 Smart Reads, and maybe I'll put together like a drug pricing primer, because I think we get bombarded with a lot of different headlines and narratives that it's hard to determine what's true. But, you know, I'm really proud of this administration for getting in the Inflation Reduction Act the provision that Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services will negotiate price on 10 drugs, starting with 10 drugs that are of immense need and that they are reimbursing at high rates, but are priced for profitability and not for patient benefit or accessibility. And these drug sponsors will tell you this is going to affect innovation. We already offer discounts through rebates, et cetera. But let's be clear. In my industry, it's little guys like us who are doing the big bulk of innovation. Global Biopharma has some things that they're scaling up, and they are commercial engines, but they are no longer R&D centers anymore. They're acquiring technologies from small companies like us. So I call BS on that, 1. 2, to claim you have a rebate that is still so difficult to be for the patient to navigate, this patient is taking a number of medications, one of them priced so highly that they wonder if they're going to be able to buy food, pay certain bills, et cetera. At no point should price trump patient benefit. And so what Mark Cuban has done with his cost plus drugs is showing what the transparency is, because he sells everything at cost plus 15% and shipping and handling. So you know exactly how much his pharmacy has paid from it. And he's flattening the distribution chain to go from manufacturer, distributor, him, to the patient.
It's brilliant.
And so anything you can read up or listen to interviews from his team about that, I think it's worth everyone to learn more about, and that the drugs that were picked by CMS are part of usually multi-drug regimens that these patients are taking to treat and live with chronic disease. And so with that, another read I would recommend is a book called Outlive by Dr. Peter Attia. I just read it. It's kind of my whole personality right now, but it's a brilliant book in how he talks about what does it take, like what you need to do now to maximize your health span, not just your lifespan. It doesn't matter how long you live. If the quality of your life is like you're taking multiple meds and you're having conditions that are affecting your quality of life. Like, it's not just enough to live into your 80s. You want to be a healthy, well, 80-year-old. And yes, I think we can all expect that once you hit your 80s, you're going to take a medication or two. But you should do everything you can to prevent how many you may need. And I just think it's the beautiful balance of science explained very, very clearly with very specific, tangible takeaways. And many of them are just tweaks. If you live a pretty healthy lifestyle, It's like he's first thing he'll tell you is to prioritize more sleep. Something all of us want to do, but maybe hearing it in his way, it helped me say, I would love to watch that extra episode, but I know I need my 7 hours. So time to turn it off and start winding down. Or when I'm moving my body, his talk about zone 2 versus zone 5 cardio, I'm no longer like just punishing myself on the treadmill or on my Peloton. And I'm actually like forcing myself to stay in a specific heart rate zone during my longer cardio workouts. And then I add on like a quick HIIT ride at the very end to spike up my heart rate and focus on that zone 5 training. I'm lifting weights a lot more and doing a mix of heavy lifting and Pilates and sort of micro strength training and resistance training. So I really believe in both and. I'm so glad and proud to work in an industry that is creating life-saving medications. And I also hope people don't need them.
1000%. Because people will ultimately always need them, mm-hmm. but a healthier lifestyle will perhaps limit the intake that they need of them.
Exactly.
That, and perhaps we all need to go move to the blue zone.
I would be bored in a blue zone.
I'm sorry. I want to go visit one just to, I mean, the specific blue zone is Icarus. There's a specific blue zone mm-hmm. that has all of these amazing sort of homeopathic lifestyle elements coming out of it. I just want to go visit. There's one little specific island, supposedly, and I haven't been. Whatever. Maybe we all just need to go visit a blue zone for once in our lifetime. And maybe that coupled with life-saving drugs and a better lifestyle as a foundation is the ticket to living longer, because there's no sense in, to your point, you know, living unhappily and living with chronic pain if it's something that we foundationally can accomplish and get rid of earlier on. I mean, if we can actually
mitigate against.
Yes, mitigate. That's mitigate the word I'm against. Looking for. Yeah. It's the end of our day, and I think that's why I'm like losing it. But no, to that end, if we can foundationally support our lifestyle so that we can limit the drug intake and really support what our future looks like, everybody benefits mm-hmm. and our families.
I mean, I'll say the last thing is, in America, we don't have a true healthcare system. We have a disease management system.
Oh, of course. That's we treat insane. The symptoms, not the yeah. foundation.
It's insane. Well, doctors, the way they are trained is to diagnose and treat.
Yes.
So I think when we talk about healthcare reform, it's how do we make nutritionists and health fitness, clean water, clean air, safe living environments, that needs to be a part of the system. And public health has been crying for this for years, if not centuries. But it's time we stop treating public health and healthcare administration as two separate things, and we really need to start integrating it together.
Of course they are. Well, if you look at our nutrition system and you look at the 5 food groups, I mean, that's not even a thing. I don't understand. Like, it comes down to good carbs, mm-hmm. good fats, and good protein. It's really that simple.
And fiber. Lots of fiber.
Right. But, you know, you can find that within yeah. your good carb set. But, like, people don't, they think you have to, oh, well, I have to have this amount of meat and dairy. Like, okay, by the way, dairy is just liquid animal. I mean, it kills me. It's liquid animal, right? Cheese, milk, right?
I love cheese and milk and yogurt. And I'll just say this, too. It is a personal thing.
Yeah.
Whether it's something you just don't like eating or if your body has a hard time metabolizing.
Absolutely.
But we also need to be able to celebrate the personalized approach that's going to help everybody yes. thrive,
yes.
not just survive.
Yes. And nutritionists should be compensated through exactly. insurance companies. That's a major issue for me. But in any case, I could speak with you all day long. I loved having you here today with me. Hitha, thank you so much for joining me on All Over Again podcast. I'm so grateful to you.
So grateful to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the All Over Again podcast. I hope that you learned something from today's episode. If you enjoyed this, please leave a 5-star review about All Over Again on Apple Podcasts. Please also let me know what spoke to you about the episode on our social media channels @AllOverAgainPodcast. I can't wait to hear from you.